Show, who is most recently the author of To End All Wars. Adam, how are you doing?
Very good.
I wanted to first of all start with what was considered morally permissible in warfare up until World War I. Mustard and chlorine gas used for the first time. The first air raid on London on May 31st, 1915. Distinctions between civilians and soldiers evaporated. Everybody was killed. Germany pushed into starvation. You write at the end of the book that human beings would probably have devised methods for inflicting such terror and death upon each other eventually. But what do you think ultimately caused this transgression? Just to sort of get a nice little start here, was it pure human arrogance? Was it the level of technology that was presented at human disposal, similar to the Ray Bradbury story, The Flying Machine? Or what was it, ultimately?
Well, I think it was, you know, these enormous, powerful, heavily industrialized countries found themselves at war with each other and immediately felt it was a fight to the death. And when you feel it's a fight to the death, that your very national existence is at stake, and this was how they felt about it and portrayed it, this is what their propaganda said, when you feel that your very existence or survival as a nation is at stake, and both sides felt this way, then very quickly everything becomes permissible. And, you know, the first people to see that were Allied soldiers. First on the Eastern Front in Russia, actually, and then in Belgium, who saw clouds of gas wafting towards them. Nothing like this had been done in warfare before.
Yeah. Well, let's talk also about the Women's Social and Political Union. It's this militant women's suffrage organization, which was galvanized by one of the characters in the book, Emmeline Pankhurst. She smashed windows, all these women did. They smashed windows, they slashed letters onto golf courses and made sure they stayed by going ahead and dousing it with acid. They set houses on fire. Suffragette activity halted, of course, when the war stopped up. You have the WSPU majority. They start supporting the war. They organize a rally on the great need of vigorous national defense against the German peril. This, of course, causes a split amongst the Pankhurst family. Sylvia Pankhurst devoting her attention to speaking out against the war. Yet in 1918, the Parliamentary Qualifications of Women Act, giving women over 21 the right to stand as MP, is in fact, that passes. In 1918, the franchise was extended to women over the age of 30. So I'm wondering if the First World War, rather perversely, managed to help the women's suffrage movement along. I mean, did it sort of allow the WSPU to make their position a little bit more palatable to the public? What of this? I mean, is it along with the lines of what we were discussing earlier about, well, human beings would have massacred each other eventually, or in this case, they would have allowed women the right to vote eventually?
Well, the First World War probably did speed women's suffrage along in the United States and certainly in England. Don't forget, though, that there were some places where even before the First World War, women had the right to vote. Finland, New Zealand, a few other places. So it would have come sooner or later anyway. I made the Pankhurst family characters in this book because what I was trying to do was to retell the story of this war, not so much as a battle between two sides, but a battle between those who thought the war was a noble and necessary crusade and those who thought it was absolute madness and either refused to fight themselves or, if they were overage or women, tried to encourage others to refuse to fight. And it seemed to me the most dramatic way to bring that out would be to talk about the splits in families.
Yeah.
And the Pankhursts are a particularly interesting example this way because prior to the war, Emmeline Pankhurst and her two of her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, had been the leaders of the absolutely most militant wing of the movement for women's suffrage in Britain.
Yeah.
Emmeline Pankhurst, on the eve of the war, was arrested for literally throwing a rock through the window of 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence. And in fact, when the first shots of the war were fired, she was a fugitive from British justice.
Yes.
In France. The moment the war began, she ceased all her suffrage activities, and she and her daughter Christabel put themselves at the service of the British government, carried out missions for the government. They went on speaking tours of England, speaking tours of the United States, both of them. And Emmeline was even sent to Russia by the government to try to rally Russian women for the war effort. Meanwhile, the other daughter, Sylvia, was very much against the war. Throughout, for most of its duration, she published the most widely read anti-war newspaper in Britain, Women's Dreadnought, then called Workers' Dreadnought. And she and her mother virtually stopped speaking to each other at that point and really never did again. Sylvia's politics had always been a little bit to the left of her mother's, but they had still worked very, very closely together. And Sylvia had, prior to the war, had a long, very intense, passionate, secret love affair with Keir Hardie, the great British labor leader, who was really one of Britain's most eloquent voices against the war until he died in 1915.
Yeah. Well, of Hardie, I'm curious about his inclusion because, yes, he died in 1915. He was extremely adamant about protesting the war. He gets a stroke shortly before he dies, so this slows him down, and yet he's still speaking out against it. Yeah, people are just totally insulting him. A fellow politician says, well, he was crippled in spirit and the like. And so I'm curious if his efforts were not successful and Hardie is not necessarily as remembered for his anti-war outbursts, then why should we remember him as a historical figure in this way?
Well, I think he was a great man. Extraordinary history. He had been born in dirt floor poverty.
Yeah. And also the first labor to be into parliament as
well.
That's
right.
First labor member.
Dirt floor poverty in Glasgow. He was born out of wedlock, as his mother had been. When he was 9, 10 years old, his stepfather was out of work, and he was the sole support of the family. Saw a brother die at home. And from the age of 10 till 21, he worked in the mines, underground all day long. Taught him, never went to school. Adults helped him learn to read and write. He couldn't afford to buy books. He practiced by picking up newspapers from the sidewalk, looking at books displayed in bookstore windows. And he never even left Scotland until he was 30 years old. He was head of the Scottish Mine Workers Union. And then he found socialism. It satisfied his enormous idealism. He felt a great solidarity with, you know, socialist leaders in other countries, in France and Germany. He began traveling to the continent for gatherings of the Second International, the great conglomeration of socialist parties and labor movements. And of course, he and the people who felt as he did in France and Germany hoped that workers in all countries would feel solidarity with each other and would refuse to fight this war. And Hardie tried to get French and German socialists to agree with him to stage a general strike if their country seemed to be going to war. Couldn't get them to agree to this. And of course, he and all the others found out once the war began that appeal of tribal loyalty to one's nation or tribe transcended any kind of appeal that they could make, and it was devastating for Hardie. It really broke his heart.
Yeah. It's an unsuccessful story. Should history really be in the business of remembering the losers as well?
Well, first of all, for me as a writer, it was a challenge to see if I could write a narratively interesting and emotionally meaningful story about a movement that failed. My last book was about the anti-slavery movement in the British Empire. That was a successful movement. Slavery did come to an end. These people failed to stop the First World War, but I still find them very, very much worth writing about because it takes a special kind of courage and nobility to go against the patriotic madness that's in the air. And very often, you know, a movement like this, it doesn't succeed the first time.
Yeah.
We still haven't stopped war today. We're caught up in at least two unnecessary wars, in my view, in the United States right now. I would like to see people who oppose those wars take some inspiration from these earlier folks, even though they failed.
On the other hand, I actually wanted to bring up your recent Tom's Dispatch article in which you draw parallels between our present times and World War I. I'm wondering if it's an appropriate parallel simply because, well, World War I, there was considerably more death. presently, you say, well, why aren't we protesting the war? Well, we did in 2003. There was the biggest protest in America against the conflict in Iraq.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if really the parallels should line up, or whether we should consider the full scope of any kind of war when considering it. I mean, is there a danger here of, I suppose, parallel relativism or what? Maybe you could expand upon
this. Well, I don't think the parallels to anything are ever exact or anywhere near exact when there's nearly 100 years in between. But I guess some of the parallels I saw between the First World War and those that we're in today are several. First, look at how the First World War started. Austria-Hungary was eager to make war on little Serbia right next door. They felt the existence of Serbia was a threat because there were a lot of restless ethnic Serbs within the borders of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. They'd actually drawn up invasion plans to invade Serbia and dismember it. Then Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary gets assassinated by an ethnic Serb, but an Austro-Hungarian citizen. And there's no evidence that the top officials of Serbia's government even knew about the assassination plot, but they immediately used this as an excuse to make war on Serbia. I see some resemblance between that and Bush using the September 11th attacks to make war in Iraq, which had nothing to do with those attacks.
Yeah.
So when countries are hungering to go to war with, for one reason or another, they can easily use something as an excuse. That's one similarity. I think another is that most of the time, a country starts a war, they expect it to be over very quickly and easily. Kaiser Wilhelm II, when he sent his troops off to France in 1914, said, "You will be home before the leaves have fallen from the trees." And the Germans had this master plan that they'd worked on for years that very systematically and with great exactitude showed how they were going to subdue France, conquer Paris, force a French surrender in exactly 42 days.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't happen that way. But countries always expect it to happen that way, like when Bush landed on the aircraft carrier in 2003 in front of that big sign, "Mission accomplished."
Sure.
Well, I'm still not completely sure what the mission was in Iraq, but whatever it was, it hasn't been accomplished.
Yes. And well, we just recently had another mission accomplished, allegedly, with the Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you saw some of the New York Post headlines here that were really, really grisly. On the other hand, I should point out that there is a fundamental difference between, say, Al-Qaeda, which is networked all around the world, versus the German nation, which is starving, which is basically going ahead and machine gunning down soldiers, and soldiers on the other side are machine gunning them, and there's this trench warfare and all that. There's even a sense of gentlemanly accord in World War I that one doesn't see in the present conflict, especially when you also factor in communications. I mean, there's nothing even close parallel-wise to WikiLeaks, for example, that you could actually have in World War I. That's why I'm sort of unclear as to the parallels. Are the parallels more in the way that governments inform their people, governments persuade their people to become involved in a conflict, or what?
Well, as I say, the parallels from 100 years ago are never completely exact, but there was a sort of WikiLeaks episode in World War I, which was this. In 1917 came the two Russian revolutions, the February Revolution when they overthrew the Tsar, and the October Revolution when the Bolsheviks seized power in a coup. At that point, the Bolsheviks got into the Tsarist archives, and they made public all the secret treaties that Russia, France, and the agreements that Russia, France, England, and Italy had that showed how the Allies were planning to divide up the possessions of Germany and its allies once the war was over. And it had tremendous reverberations in the same way that the WikiLeaks material did, in recent months, because it showed that, you know, even though the Allies, like the Germans, were saying they were fighting to defend civilization itself, nonetheless, they'd actually drawn lines on the map as to how they were going to divide up spheres of influence in the Middle East, for example.
Okay. I wanted to shift back to conscientious objectors. The case of Margaret Hobhouse. She's a well-to-do woman. Her son, Stephen, is imprisoned as a conscientious objector. This suggests, to some degree, this whole incident where she writes a book that is, of course, ghostwritten by Bertrand Russell, I Appeal Unto Caesar, that it takes the rich or the privileged in order to actually shift things, because she manages to persuade 26 bishops, 200 other clergymen, to sign a statement arguing for more lenient treatment of COs. Similarly, in 1916, some COs are sent to France. They're fed bread and water. They're forced to the front line. The No Conscription Fellowship is on the case trying to seek them out. But, of course, because they don't have this Hobhousian connection, it's a great difficulty to actually track these folks down. At the beginning of 1918, there were still more than 1,000 COs behind bars. You have Basil Thompson noting that pacifism was on the rise. Now, this comes after I Appeal Unto Caesar was published. Why was there such a delay between 1916 and 1918 in drawing attention to these maltreated COs? I mean, did it take a book? Does it take a privileged person speaking on behalf of COs to ensure humane treatment for them of all classes? Or what of this?
Well, obviously, at all times and places, I think when people from wealthy families and so on speak out loudly in behalf of something, their voices carry much more loudly.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately the way the world works. One thing that was interesting to me about the war resisters in Britain, though, was that they came from across the class spectrum. You had people in jail like Stephen Hobhouse, whom you mentioned, who was from this very ancient, wealthy family filled with connections to lords and bishops and so on. A very close friend of the family was in the cabinet, Alfred Milner, who was minister without portfolio in charge of coordinating the war effort. At the same time, there were labor unionists in jail who didn't have those powerful connections. And these folks all felt a real sense of solidarity with each other across those class lines.
But was the book really the linchpin to, I guess, I mean, I don't want to draw any false correlation here, but I'm curious how this connects to Basil Thompson saying, oh, well, pacifism is on the rise. Is that more the awareness of COs, or is that more just people in grief because bodies are coming back or not coming back, or they're getting, you know, messages that their loved ones are dead?
Well, actually, the book you mentioned, it by Margaret Hobhouse, because it was allegedly written by Margaret Hobhouse,
yes,
who was the wife of a prominent churchman and a big landowner and everything, it had a considerable effect, although in fact Bertrand Russell secretly co-authored it. The book helped bring about the release of several hundred conscientious objectors who were in poor health in one way or another. But that's about all it did. The government still kept locking up conscientious objectors who refused to do alternative service. It still cracked down, with increasing harshness on people who spoke out against the war. Bertrand Russell, despite being himself the son of an earl, he later inherited the earldom from his brother, was sent to jail for 6 months in 1918. Edmund Dean Morrell, really the country's leading investigative journalist, spent 6 months in jail for his anti-war writings, served at hard labor, and it broke his health, and he died a few years later.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk about some of the writers. The two most prominent jingoistic ones that come up are Rudyard Kipling and John Buchan, known, of course, as the author of The 39 Steps. Kipling, he lost his son John in the war, but even after that, he remained a fairly hardline imperialist. You have one moment in the book where he tells a younger man, I hate your generation because you were going to give it all away about the British Empire. He did write The Gardener, which you describe as utterly bereft of his usual jingoism, but the loss of his son didn't entirely change his temperament. For John Buchan, the other jingoistic writer of the time, you write, there were only one or two brief hints of doubt about the war. I want to sort of tie this into what you were mentioning earlier about the Pankhursts and how a very hard ideology can cause so many interesting splits when war comes up. If these two figures could not be changed, really, I think the only literary title in this book that does actually represent, I suppose, a legitimate protest is probably P.G. Wodehouse's The Swoop, which satirizes the flood of all these invasion novels that are published around the time. I mean, how could any literary figure have made a difference, really? Or how could they have been changed? Or how could their change have really affected the tide or caused a more pacifistic change or sentiment or ripple in the tide?
Well, who knows? We would have to sort of imagine a counterfactual history where Kipling, who'd been a tremendous drumbeater for imperial wars all his life, if he'd suddenly had a change of heart and came out for negotiated peace, I don't think it would have changed everything, but it certainly would have startled people. On the other hand, you know, most people and most writers' political stance is pretty clear once they are in their 20s or 30s and does not change that much despite what the circumstances are. You would think if circumstances could have changed anything, changed anybody, it would have changed Kipling, because here he had been this tremendous militarist all his life, encouraged his son to think of a military career. Young John Kipling was eager to go into the Navy, got turned down by medical examination there, got turned down by the Army because he'd inherited his dad's bad eyesight. You know, every time you see those pictures of Rudyard Kipling, he always has those very thick glasses on. Rudyard Kipling pulled strings, went to a field marshal the family knew, finally got John Kipling commissioned in the Army as an officer. John Kipling went into action at the Battle of Loos in 1915 and was never seen again.
Yeah.
And it absolutely devastated his father, who even arranged for fighter pilots to drop leaflets over the German lines saying, if anybody knows where this boy or his body is, get in touch. But it didn't change Rudyard Kipling's enthusiasm for the war, sadly.
Yeah. So Kipling and Buchan are best understood as contributing to the spirit of propaganda? Or how do we find the sort of complexity
much,
here?
Very much so. I mean, Kipling kept writing warlike fiction throughout the war, wrote a tremendous amount of nonfiction as well, pamphlets and articles based on spending time with the troops in France and various other fronts. He kept barraging the government with suggestions for propaganda films to make. He went and spoke at factories and other places. John Buchan was a number of things simultaneously. He was really the inventor of the modern spy novel. He kept writing spy novels during the war. He was tremendously prolific. The most famous one, The 39 Steps, Alfred Hitchcock later made into a film. In some of Buchan's later novels are actually conscientious objectors appear.
Yeah.
But as good guys who are serving in a non-combatant role and perform heroically at the front. Buchan was also, the second half of the war, the chief of the British propaganda operation. He served at the front in uniform as an officer on the staff of General Haig, who was commander-in-chief on the Western Front, and he was also writing dispatches for the London Times at the same time, wearing many different hats simultaneously. And as you mentioned, he had some doubts after the war. He very poignantly, because in the war he lost his best friend, his brother, many, many people he knew. After the war, he said he could never bear to read Homer again. All these, you know, upper-class Brits, you know, read Latin and Greek and so on. He could never bear to read Homer again because of the way Homer glorified war. And he was an enthusiast for the League of Nations. Not that it stopped war, but that he hoped that it would.
Yeah. Well, you also kind of incriminate Sir Arthur Conan Doyle as well for contributing not as hardcore as Buchan and Kipling, but nevertheless having a few flashes of military martial qualities to him. But I'm wondering if that's entirely fair. I mean, he was only bringing back Holmes again, so I'm not sure if it's entirely fair to like go ahead and frame him like
Conan
that.
Doyle brought Holmes out of retirement
to
foil a German spy conspiracy in England.
But it wasn't just for the German spy conspiracy.
No, he wrote some other stuff as well. But Doyle had done most of his work by the time of the war. But Buchan was really just beginning and continued to write all through the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, I also wanted to bring up a Wall Street Journal review of this book by William Anthony Hay. He suggested that you stack the deck by presenting unappealing characters as foils for the pacifists and liberals. Sir Douglas Haig, I think I might be able to agree with him on that, because here is a very blundering man who can neither talk coherently. Even John Buchan, who we were just talking about, observed how terrible he was with his soldiers. But he also can't seem to comprehend the scope of the battlefield in front of him until really later in the book. Mr. Hay writes that the radicals had no better grasp of the war and what was being lost all around them. To respond to Mr. Hay's criticism, was there anybody in World War I who really grasped the impact at the time? I mean, we talked earlier about how they thought it would be a sort of short, brisk war. Did the slow communication combined with the censorship prevent just about every party from understanding what was going on? How difficult, also, by the way, was it for you to find positive qualities about a blunderbuss such as Sir Douglas Haig?
Well, actually, I would disagree with the charge that I stacked the deck, because to me, there were a number of people who, on the pro-war side, who were personally quite appealing. You know, Winston Churchill, you know, who was a big thunderer for the war and who took part in it, is a tremendously appealing human being.
And also happened to
be in
every major battle at the time.
He was, in 1918, he was Minister of Munitions, which meant he, you know, should have been back home in England attending to munitions factories, but he used every possible excuse to visit the front and somehow managed to be there at the front line, staying in a divisional headquarters in 1918 when the Germans launched their huge offensive that almost won the war for them at that point. But Churchill, I find enormously appealing as a human being. I don't agree with his politics, but wonderfully appealing as a human being, who always had something memorable to say, a way of phrasing things that you just can't resist quoting. Sir John French, the first commander-in-chief on the Western Front, who's a very central character in the book, I find humanly much more likable. I would rather spend an evening with him than I would with his pacifist sister, who seems rather humorless and who very uncritically adopted every radical cause of the day. Some of them good, you know, freedom for Ireland, freedom for India. Some of them crazy, like, you know, she felt paradise had arrived in Soviet Russia. I don't think the appealing and unappealing people are distributed all to one side or the other.
But Sir Douglas Haig, who you have conveniently not talked about in this answer, I mean, he does not come across very well. And I noticed that near the end you were sort of throwing him a few positive bones and led me to believe that it was pretty difficult to look at this guy as anything less than a sort of thick-headed guy who wanted to sort of live in some manner in the distance while men were just walking into their deaths, you know?
But, I mean, how could you not feel critical of a man like this? Here is somebody who got upset when the British divisions under his command failed to suffer a lot of casualties in an engagement because he had no way of knowing what the other side's casualties were. He could only assume after a hard-fought battle that the German casualties were sort of equal to those of the British. So if the British hadn't suffered casualties to the degree he felt appropriate, he got upset at one point after one battle. You know, he complained that a division had only had 1,000 casualties. I mean, you contrast this with somebody like General Eisenhower in World War II, who, you know, also led men through a terrible war, but who really seemed to feel it on his heart and, you know, feel his soul worn down when he knew that he was sending people to their death.
On the other hand, the fact that Haig managed to stay in some serious position for such a long time indicates that, well, he had some kind of talent or charisma or some ability. I mean, is there anything positive you could say about the guy?
Well, no charisma, but I think some of the same qualities that made him appear thick-headed in the earlier parts of the war, absolute optimism, belief that the British were going to win. He would always believe they were going to win next week, next month. That ended up taking 4 years. But that quality and a sort of determination meant that he did hold firm and be an example to his men to hold firm when the Germans launched their final great offensive, which almost won but finally failed in 1918.
Yeah. Well, you could always draw, just we've been drawing parallels earlier, perhaps Haig was the George W. Bush of his time. Who knows? I wanted to talk also about Lord Lansdowne. He was a right-leaning politician. He published, of course, the infamous Lansdowne letter in the Telegraph, writing that the prolongation of the war will spell great ruin for the civilized world. He was stunned one day to discover that all these socialists were now in his corner. You note that his efforts did not spark any new peace movements. In fact, shortly after the Lansdowne letter, Britain and Germany explicitly forbade any further negotiations. I'm wondering, did the Lansdowne letter, did it hurt the peace movement more than help it?
Well, I don't think, much as I admire them and want to rescue them for history in this book, the peace movement in on the Allied side never really did have a realistic chance of prevailing during the war. So I don't think you can say that somebody like Lansdowne speaking out hurt them. But it did bring them an unexpected ally in high places. He himself was a former foreign minister. He'd been in various posts in the cabinet. In fact, while he was foreign minister, he helped engineer the secret understandings with France that virtually ensured Britain would come into the war on the French side. But he was appalled at the death toll. He lost a son himself. He was particularly appalled that the upper classes, the aristocracy, were suffering a disproportionately high toll from the war because, of course, these young Oxford, Cambridge-educated captains and lieutenants who were leading the men out of the trenches and into a hail of machine gun fire. And finally, he was brave enough to speak out in the fall of 1917, and his former friends shunned him, and the socialists, who were an anathema to him, he was a big landowner, embraced him with great enthusiasm. And the intelligence agents, and one of the fun things in writing this book was to look through the Scotland Yard agents' reports and the military intelligence agents' reports, began hunting for people showing signs of Lansdownism, they called it.
Wow. Do they have any other terms for this mania or whatever? Or do they consider the mania?
Well, that's my favorite new word that I discovered in there.
Huh. I wanted to talk about the notion of courage. In writing a book like this, much as you're also trying to find ways to make blundering military figures more palatable, you're also countering notions of what is considered courageous. You know, when you look at untrained pilots who are going up against the Red Baron and losing their lives while he just shoots them down, when you talk about men who just push forward, going to the next trench and grabbing the German artillery, that is considered to be very brave. And you're trying to counter that bravery with other forms of bravery which aren't so cut and dry, which involve loss of reputation but not necessarily loss of life. I'm curious if it's even possible to find some centrist point so that regular people can understand that an act of resistance in terms of I'm not going to go to war is as much an act of courage as that of going to war. I mean, you know, what is your stance in terms of the bravery of these soldiers who do, in fact, go to war and do make sacrifices? That's serious business. Is there any, again, this is another question involving relativism, but it is one I think that's important. And if we are going to talk about pacifism, we have to understand that, relatively speaking, the loss of a life versus the suspension of a life are two entirely different things.
They are, and you know, you have to admire, in a sense, the courage of people in battle who, you know, risk their lives, whether it's, you know, going after another fighter plane in the air or charging forward into machine gun fire. Although, keep in mind, at least for the people on the ground, they didn't have much choice. In the British Army, for example, they had a line of people called battle police who followed closely behind the soldiers who were ordered to move forward just to be sure that none of them turned around and tried to run the other way.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, you know, there's certainly many acts of bravery within combat that happen when, you know, somebody needlessly or unnecessarily exposes himself to fire to rescue somebody who's wounded or whatever. But I'm more interested in the other kind of courage because I think it gets celebrated and talked about much less. The courage that it takes to stick to your beliefs that this war is nonsense and not worth being fought when the streets are filled with people cheering, when there are people who make fun of you, who, you know, throw eggs and rotten tomatoes at you if you speak out about what you believe in. All of these anti-war types, face tremendous disruption, insults, threats, and sometimes real physical violence when they spoke at public meetings.
Certainly, but on the other hand, it does take a certain put your head down as the people are forcing us to go to the front. I mean, that's not exactly something that one should discount. And most people understand that as a function of war, as a regrettable reality of war. And if you want to get people to consider the other kinds of courage, I'm not sure if simply presenting an alternative form isn't always going to do the job for all people. So what is the band-aid, so to speak, between these, without using a pun, between these two courages, two types of courage?
Well, I think they're two different kinds of things, but I still would submit that it can take as much for somebody to stick to their beliefs as it can to go into battle. I mean, just to give one example that I use in the book, in 1916, the British hadn't, when they had just instituted the draft, they hadn't yet figured out exactly how they were going to handle conscientious objectors, people who refused to fight and who refused this alternative service. And so they drafted them into the army. They treated them as if they were soldiers. They treated them as if they were soldiers disobeying orders. And there was this group of some 50 conscientious objectors who were not only taken into the army, but who were taken across the English Channel to France, and who were told, if you refuse to obey orders here, you will be shot because we are at the front. And not one of those 50 reneged on his beliefs.
Yeah.
In the end, they were saved by a last-minute intervention. An order came from the Prime Minister, don't shoot these people. But they didn't know that until they stood out on the parade ground to hear their sentences read. So, to me, that's courage.
I certainly agree that it's courage, but I guess, are we dealing with a situation of non-overlapping magisteria when it comes to different types of courage? Or I'm still unclear as to how one could appreciate both.
I think you can appreciate both. I mean, I do appreciate the courage of a soldier in wartime who, you know, risks his life to rescue somebody, something like that. I just would hope that it would be a war worth fighting. This one wasn't to me. But the man can still be courageous within it.
Well, on that note, Adam, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Good. It was a pleasure.
Great, thanks.
Good.